Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. In this show, what we do is something amazing made possible by the internet, and which is not affected by the pandemic so much because we do it on the internet already. We get people from different parts of the world, sometimes very, very far apart. We get together around a cozy Skype conversation, and we talk about what's been happening. And what you get out of it, hopefully, is some different perspectives, different opinions, and different views on the happenings of the world. And it enriches your life, or at least it's entertaining while you're doing boring stuff like, you know, your dishes and driving to work. Now, you're probably not driving to work, but you still need to be entertained or at least informed. We're going to strive to do both. My name is Patrick Beja, and I'm very glad to be welcoming to the show two first comers. First of all, Hannah from Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. How's it going, Hannah?
It's great. Thank you.
Is it, though? Is it?
Well, no. Hey, it's great to be doing something different, talking to different people, you know, who are not my husband, my child. So, yay.
Absolutely. And you are one of the two co-hosts of the Southeast Asia Travel Show, which is a podcast that just launched. And that is a great time to be launching a podcast about travel, isn't it?
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, actually, it's kind of timely in a way because we talk more about the travel industry rather than travel tips. So in a way, there's more to talk about, I guess. You know, more people, you know, want to hear about your take on it and any insights you can share, because I think everybody is desperate for kind of good news, right? But yeah, it's a funny time to have started a podcast. We just started in January at the beginning this year. And yeah, I mean, I'm in the travel industry anyhow, which again is not really a great industry to be in. It's a little bit of a difficult one at the moment. But we're all just trying to find our way around it. So I'm based here in KL in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur. I'm originally from the UK, but I've been in Malaysia the last 8 years or so now. So I'm a bit of a local here almost, I like to think. And we've now been in lockdown for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So it's getting a little bit old now. We've still got another 2 weeks left. So it's meant to be lifted, lockdown here is meant to be lifted 12th of May. But we'll see. They keep doing this thing where they keep extending it every 2 weeks.
Right.
So just as it gets to the end. They'll extend it another 2 weeks.
Yeah. it's possibly, I mean, we'll see what happens. But we'll talk about this more in just a little bit and all the fun that's been. But first, let me welcome the second guest on the show, Paul. Actually, I'm not sure how I should pronounce your last name. Is it Jiguer? Jiguer? It's French in origin. But I guess I'll pronounce it the French way. Jiguer. Paul Jiguer.
That is correct. I figured if anybody I know was going to get it right, you would, because my high school couldn't get it right for 4 years.
Well, I am very glad to be of service. So you are in Calgary, Canada. We bonded over weather reports, which are very similar. And yeah, so it's pretty cold out there. You are in lockdown as well, I understand. And you have kids. And you were telling us just a moment ago how you would much rather have one kid. Well, actually, that might make you sound bad. You are very happy with your two kids, I suppose. But it's more work than just one kid, which is wonderful math, right?
Yes, it is. It is. It definitely. I could be worse. My sister-in-law has 5 kids in her house with her.
The oldest
is 16 now, and the youngest is like 10. I think she just turned 10. So
why, Paul? Why? Why would anyone do this? That's what I ask her all
the time. Yeah, actually, you know, even my sister has got 6. Kind of a mix of stepchildren and natural children. And, I just can't imagine it. And she works from home. She's always worked from home. And now I'm like, how on earth did you do that? You're a superwoman.
It is kind of showing us how insane this is. Although, I guess often, hopefully, when people are stay-at-home parents, they don't also have a full-time job that they are expected to do at the same time. But Paul, you're actually, is it still the case? You're a stay-at-home dad, or you were for a little while, right?
Right now, I currently am, technically, because of the pandemic. I was laid off. I think I'm going on four weeks of being out of work. We have a very strong employment insurance program in Canada, so I'm being paid by the government, basically, right now to stay home and take care of my kids and everything, so...
And still, so it's your main, yeah, I misunderstood. I thought you had been for a little bit longer, but so you, it is essentially you're taking care of this and your partner, is working. Wife. So it's your primary responsibility to be taking care of the kids and you're slowly going insane, correct?
You know what, to be fair, the first couple of weeks were okay. There was a middle part of the last, because my kids have been home now for almost 7 weeks.
Yeah.
And the middle part, I had a couple of days where week or so where it was bad, and I just wasn't interested in helping get their online school organized and stuff, because it just was kind of a lot of extra work. But now that the weather's kind of turned a little nicer out here and our snow's melting and we can start to go outside and get some actual fresh air, it's getting a little better.
Mm. Yeah, it feels like there was a kind of, I don't want to say elation in the beginning, that's obviously very much too strong of a word, but there was enthusiasm in the beginning, like, all right, we're going to do this, or at least courage. And over the past, I would say there was a turning point around week 4 or 5, it feels like everyone who has kids, and that's very anecdotal evidence on my part, those who don't have kids are kind of on a fairly even line. Those who have kids are like, oh my God, this has to stop. Like, I don't care. We have to reopen the schools. Not I don't care, but there's a desperate tone in the voice of the people who have kids who are like, please, can we, like, I really hope daycare reopens soon. If it doesn't,
yeah. I better.
Yeah, it's the same for you,
Hannah. I was just actually about 10 minutes before we started this, I was just frantically reading a news article online that they had just released from our health minister saying, oh no, childcare and education are going to be the last things to reopen. What?
Oh my God.
Come on, guys.
I would move away from Malaysia, like, right now. If that was the case. Like, yeah, I'm going back to the UK, whatever. Like, I'll just hitch a ride on a, like, in a cargo plane somewhere. And so let's talk about this a little bit, about how it's been going in Malaysia. But before we do, I just want to thank the patrons of this show at patreon.com/thephileasclub. If you enjoy the show, please please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thephileasclub. The link is in the show notes. You can do that in a couple of minutes. It is the way the show is funded, the reason the show exists. So if you enjoy it, if you've been having a good time, or if you're getting something out of it, please do consider going to patreon.com/thephileasclub. And again, the link is in the show notes. Thank you a million times to those who choose to support the show, because first of all, you are the reason the show that exists, and second of all, you are my favorite people in the world. My son is a close second, along with my wife, but you are my favorite people. All right, so Kuala Lumpur, honestly, I was excited to have you on the show, Hannah, because I don't know a lot about Malaysia, and I'm very curious to hear how things have been going in a part of the world that I really don't know much about. Obviously hit by the pandemic as well. About 6 weeks ago, sheltering started. It seems like it's on par with Western countries in terms of the stage of the pandemic, and it's dealing with it in the same way. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, I mean, so I think the funny thing actually about being in Southeast Asia is everybody was on the alert, I think, a lot earlier than they were in Western countries, and certainly in like Europe and North America, just because of the proximity to China, and there's so much more traffic between Malaysia and other Southeast Asian countries like Thailand and Singapore to China. So that already, I think, by the beginning, even mid-January, I remember I came down with quite a heavy cold and I was still going out, you know, and you're sneezing and things, and people are giving you a look like, really? Should I be avoiding you? Have you got something?
Well, do you know if you got COVID-19? Because you might have.
I don't think so, but I would. You know, you panic about it, because I'd just been to Thailand, and then I'd researched that the flight that, you know, that had left an hour before mine had gone to Wuhan. Then you start thinking, oh my God, maybe I had it. But I'm pretty sure I didn't.
Well, I mean, maybe not, but maybe you did. I've heard from several people who, yeah. And in which case, actually, we're not sure that immunity is guaranteed if you've had it. So maybe we're all out of luck in that case. But if you have had it, then your family probably has had it. And if you have immunity, then you're fine. You can just go out and have fun and party.
Right. That would be cool. But who knows? So even from the beginning of January, there was already this kind of awareness about...
She left the conversation. Oh my God, I'm sure she's going to come back. Internet is what happens when you are connected to people from very far away. So let's wait for her to come back. There she goes, she's back. Hey, welcome back, Hannah.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you again. I guess your internet dropped out for a second. No matter, you were telling us about how it went.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. Internet. So already in January, there was this awareness of coronavirus, and it just kind of steadily built. And our numbers are still pretty low. So I just checked them out this evening, and it's still less than 6,000 cases. We've had 100 deaths. That's it. But Malaysia took the step of, doing quite a severe lockdown. So that was about 6 weeks ago now. Initially, it was only for a two-week period, and then I said they keep extending it for 2 weeks and extending it for 2 weeks. But it's strict in that you're not even allowed out for exercise. So you're allowed out to do essential services, the supermarkets and things. But yeah, you can't just go for a jog. You know, I can't go down to the park with my son. So essentially, we are trapped in a two-bedroom apartment in a condo on the 28th floor. So it's a good job that I've got a big balcony, because that's our only fresh air every day.
Your son has not gone out for 6 weeks?
Yeah, he's not been out for the first week. We have a rooftop garden here, and that was still open. And then after the first week of lockdown, even that was shut down. So yeah, he's not left the apartment actually for five weeks now. I wonder if he started to forget the outside.
You know, it's, well, first of all, let me retract my implication that I was somehow in a difficult situation, because compared to you, I have it incredibly easy. The house is really big. We live in the countryside in the middle of the forest. I should not be complaining. And yet, I managed to find a way to complain. But
yeah,
that seems to be harsh.
Everyone does, right? Everyone's got their own little thing.
And so, it seems like things are going. There's a delay, though, between, it seems, what's been happening in Malaysia and other Asian countries, like obviously China, but you know, Taiwan, South Korea, etc. Is it just because the geographically it's actually farther away than what I might imagine sitting here in Europe, or why is that so?
I don't know. Well, I think a lot of, well, actually, no, the I do know. So they got a bit lax. They got a little bit complacent back at the government here back in, I think it was the end of February or the beginning of March. And basically they let this massive religious gathering of about 20,000 people take place in Kuala Lumpur. And of course, there were a few infected people there and it just spread. So it's something like 40% of all of the cases, something around that, have all come from this one religious gathering. So that was really the thing that kind of pushed Malaysia over the edge. They were doing okay. They were controlling it. You know, they were following up, contact tracing and all of that. But just this one gathering just wiped out all of those, one of those efforts. So after that, they just decided, I think, like the only way to really, you know, try to get this under control is to impose a lockdown. Which they did pretty quickly. And, you know, I think everybody actually in the country was thinking this is the right decision. You know, we all kind of suspected it was coming. He just didn't really know when. So in February, I felt like I was, I'm self-employed and I felt like I was in a kind of race against time to get client work done because I knew at any moment they could declare that lockdown's happening, nursery's shutting down and that's it. So it was really, really racing against some unknown time.
It seems like as you were saying, the population is not really fighting it, understands why it's necessary, which I think for the most part, people in most of the world are we're in the same situation, even though you find you see, of course, you know, on TV, the extreme cases, people who are protesting. But it still seems like in Asia in general, people are more understanding of why it is necessary. I guess it's the same in Malaysia as well, a little bit more.
I think so. Perhaps it helps that some of these governments, not necessarily Malaysia, but some of the other governments in Southeast Asia are a lot more authoritarian as well. It's people, I guess, are already used to doing what the government tells them to do.
Right. Is the Malaysian people, again, that is something that's a little bit of a cliche, but we are in the West more individualistic than in Asia, where the common good and common behavior is a value that is more prevalent. Does that apply to Malaysia as well?
I don't think it does, actually, weirdly, but I've really detected it. No, I mean, and I think that's even why they've been so strict in terms of telling people that they're not allowed to go out and exercise, because I think that they worry that people, if they did say that, people would abuse that and say, I'm just going out for a jog and just go down their friend's house for a cup of coffee or something.
Interesting. So, but still, with the strictness, I'm trying to get to the bottom of this because I'm not sure I understand why it seems to be working in Malaysia and why it doesn't seem to be working as well. Even though I'm saying, you know, most people understand why it's happening, but, you know, people are impatient and you have reports everywhere of people not respecting the thing and they want to start talking about going back to normal already, which seems very premature. So it's just the strictness of the instructions which is getting across the importance of it, or maybe actually the that religious gathering was kind of a warning shot in the country, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I think it also comes down to being in Southeast Asia again. SARS was something that particularly affected Southeast Asia. I don't think it hit Malaysia very badly, but definitely Singapore. And that's kind of still within the memory of a lot of people, I think. So I think once they've kind of saw this, they thought, actually, let's just obey. I mean, it would be interesting to see how much longer this tolerance goes on, because, of course, 6 weeks in, it's going to be 2 months in total, 8 weeks that we know of may still be extended. And of course, now the economy is really suffering. A lot of people have been laid off, made redundant, put on no paid, unpaid leave or taken pay cuts. So it will be interesting now that the cases are really dropping, to see how much longer that kind of tolerance for such a strict lockdown goes on.
Yeah, it seems I reference the SARS epidemic all the time, and it's a very well-known theory, but it seems to make sense to me that it was kind of that warning shot across the bow that people have really integrated in their psyche in Asia. And this, it's a much bigger one, but this is the same for us. And if there ever is another pandemic, which there probably will be, given the state of the world.
Absolutely.
People will understand the importance of social distancing much earlier in the process. So it's interesting to hear that you're, confirming this. So it's interesting to hear that you're saying I'm right, essentially. I love it when people do that. So thank you very much.
Okay, all right. try and help you do that.
Paul, how's it going in Canada? I wanted to talk about Finland and France, but let's save that for later. How's it going in Canada? It would seem like the international cliche is that Canadians are so nice that they would probably agree to everything from the beginning. Tell us, is that the case?
I think it's been pretty well handled in Canada so far. Like I said, we've kind of been in soft lockdown since early March. We kind of started restricting, people working and telecommuting and stuff like that. And March 15th, actually, when we got the email that they were closing all the schools, and they immediately closed all the schools in the province for the rest of the school year. It wasn't spring break's coming up, we'll see how it goes after that. No, they went straight to we're done with school for the rest of the year. The initial plan was to just pass all the kids, just give them passing grades and move them on to the next grade and so forth. But they've since then started more, distance learning type of programs and stuff like that for the kids and whatnot. So, and honestly, I think our numbers have been fairly decent. Most of the projections and scales look like we're in line with a lot of European countries, doing much better than the worst cases, well below what the U.S. is experiencing and whatnot. So, in my province in Alberta, we are prairies and landlocked. Mm. And of those, we're one of the harder hit outside of the two much, much larger provinces of Ontario and Quebec. And honestly, across the country, our hardest hit areas so far have been the care homes and long-term care facilities for the elderly is everything that's being hit the hardest here.
Yeah, that's the case in France as well. I don't know about Finland specifically, but in France, I think 40% of the dead are in elder care facilities, which is obviously tragic. But so it seems, again, a fairly similar situation. I forgot to mention, for those who don't know, Malaysia has about 1.8 million people. So to relate to the number of cases you were talking about, in Finland, we have 5-6 million people, and we have, I think it's about 100, maybe a little bit more now, 150 dead. So comparatively, we started lockdown a lot earlier in the process because we were seeing what was happening in our southern neighbors and were like, holy crap, we need to get on this. And people are kind of mostly understanding of the issues and following the rules. In France, it might be the only... And for those who don't know, I'm talking about both because I'm French and I live in Finland. But in France, people are... I don't know how to describe it. Everyone is observing the rules, but kind of antsy and angry at the way the government is handling some things. And belligerent might be... Maybe it's the right way to say it. But it seems like it's... like in the US, but in a much smaller and more reasonable scale. It's like, we're not doing as well as the Germans, and why is the government not handling it better? And we want to, like, it's a country where, I don't know, everyone has people who will say something sucks, and those people will be amplified. But it seems like in France, a lot of people are saying, are complaining about a lot of things, which... Everyone who is not French is going like, duh, it's France, right? That's the image we have, I guess. But
yeah,
exactly. But it's like the government proposes some things and there's a section of the population who is like, oh, you're so dumb. And like opening the schools. Oh, why are you opening the schools? So we'll do it like progressively in steps. Why are you doing it in steps? This is so stupid. And like, I don't know. And it seems like both in Canada and Malaysia, I can't quite put my finger on it, but from your reports both, it seems like things are, maybe the way of putting it is, seems like things are going smoothly. Now, you know, smoothly in this situation might be a little bit of not the right word, but given the context, they're going as smoothly as they can, is the feeling I'm getting. Is that a fair assessment, Hannah, or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely during the first week, there were loads of people who were still breaking all of the rules, and then the police started arresting them, and then the levels went back down. I know what you mean. I think in this case maybe belligerent is the could be the right word for the French in their approach. Definitely not the Malaysian approach, I don't think.
And you're saying that initially people were breaking the rules. That's funny because that's what I heard about everyone in every country. And when people were talking about their own country, they were saying, oh, of course, the insert name of nationality here are doing this because we're idiots and we can't respect the rules. And it's like everyone was putting it in very local terms, when even in Finland, where people are usually fairly observant of rules as well, even in Finland, some people were not following the rules initially. And it took about a week until people understood the gravity of the situation. And I think it's some kind of a psychological process that you need, some people need to process it. And they do that by, you know, going out in parks and spreading the virus, I guess. Is it the case in Canada as well? Were people also not observing the rules in the first week?
I can't speak for most of the rest of the country, but based on the numbers, I think most of them have been pretty good. I definitely observed in Calgary that we were not the greatest and probably still aren't. In the province of Alberta, which for comparison, you said Finland's about 5 million. We're just over 4.3 in the province of Alberta. And Calgary is our hotspot. Over 60% of the cases are in this city alone.
And is it the biggest city, though? That would make sense, right?
I believe we're close. Edmonton is the provincial capital, so that's where our legislature and government is. I believe it's slightly smaller, but it's not a significant difference. We're kind of one of the... only prairie provinces with two fairly large cities like that in it. Whereas there are other prairie provinces next to us, Saskatchewan and Manitoba, are both much, much smaller, like just over 1 million total in there. And they have way lower numbers because they're more spread out and there's not that many people there. They're also landlocked and we're not international travel hubs. One of the things the country did do as a whole early on was restrict international travel and locked it down to only 4 airports in the whole country. And Calgary was one of them, so that is probably a reason why we had higher cases. But, I mean, just from my observations of going grocery shopping, I was early to be wearing gloves when I could, a mask when I could, when I went into the stores, and I still see lots of people who are not doing that. You know, they're constantly asking people, you know, one person per family, come into the grocery store and do the shopping. I see lots and lots of people as couples and trios doing their grocery shopping still in this situation. So, you know, and just on Saturday night, about 5 houses down from me, I was heading out to pick up some pre-ordered ice cream for me and my wife and the kids. And there was a neighbor having a garage party. It had been almost like 20, you know, late teen, early 20s kids hanging out in their garage, drinking and partying. And I'm like, are you guys insane? So, you know, I called the cops and the cops came and broke it up as best I can tell. So,
okay,
that's partly why we in Calgary are not listening. And Calgary as a whole is a very conservative part of the country. It is very much of a mentality that here they think how they make things run in America is much, much better, and they would love to have an American type system here.
Wow. Actually, we're going to get to that in a second, but I do want to mention it really seems that maybe not the entirety of the reason, but a huge factor, and that makes sense, but a huge factor of how things are spreading is the population density. And that's very obvious. But it's I'm sure that behavior, I mean, it's not that I'm sure, obviously behavior has impacts it, but even it's not the few exceptions, the few idiots that are going to keep partying that are going to dramatically change the situation of the country. It seems the population density is going to matter at that point when you put in place lockdown. I do want to go back to Hannah to ask about how Malaysians see, I'm going to say, you know, other countries. And I guess when I say other countries, obviously, I'm very self-centered. So I think Western countries. But I suspect when I ask about other countries in Malaysia, people are going to think about, you know, Asian countries, right?
Yeah. I mean, oh, being from the UK, I'll probably think of European countries too.
Okay, thank you.
But how do Malaysians see them?
Especially in the context of this crisis, like if the answer might be they don't even care about what's happening in Europe or in the US.
No, well, I mean, actually, there's a lot of kind of affinity between Malaysia and the UK, simply because Malaysia is part of the Commonwealth. It used to be part of the British Empire. They were still under the British, I think, until the 50s or 60s. So there is a great interest about what's happening in the UK in Malaysia. And that's kind of reported in the press and on social media and things. And I think people in Malaysia still couldn't believe that things like concerts were still going on in the UK and that people were just going on, you know, around like normal when, you know, in Malaysia, everyone was wearing masks and avoiding going outside and that kind of thing. I mean, even me personally, when I look at how Europe has handled it initially, I actually feel a bit angry in a way, because I saw, you know, in Asia, you've seen all these Asian countries starting to really take it very seriously and have it under control. And then you just see the US and Europe just kind of letting that advantage that China had kind of given them, that head start, kind of go to waste and not be prepared at all. And then suddenly when it hits, go, oh my God, I didn't know it was going to be so bad. Well, if you had listened and looked at what was happening in Asia, you perhaps would have been a bit better prepared than you are now, and wouldn't have let, you know, this huge crisis developed to quite such an extent.
It's funny because to me, it feels a little bit like hindsight. And because Asia, as we discussed before, had the hindsight of SARS, I suspect, you know, with SARS, they weren't as efficient.
Absolutely.
As they are being now, right?
I think so. Yeah.
And I think I mentioned this in the previous episode. I rewatched, like many people did, Contagion, the Soderbergh movie.
Yeah, I did, and now it's all I can think about.
And you know, you watch it. I saw it when it came out, like in 2012, was it? And it felt like a normal disaster movie, right? You know, Soderbergh angle, but and now when I watched it, it felt like I was watching, I don't know, you know, medieval peasants fighting the plague. I was like, are you like, when are you going to start social distancing? Like from the 10th minute of the show, of the movie, I was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? Like and you don't understand. You just don't know. If you haven't, you can learn about things in a book. You can learn about a war in a book. If you haven't been, I suspect because I have never been in a war, but if you haven't been on the field of battle, you don't know. You don't know what to do. You don't know how you're going to react. And it feels a little bit like this is the same in that you know, of course, when we look at it now, we're like, we should have done this. We should have had this prepared. We should have known that this was going to happen. But yes, of course, we should have. But it's hard for me to blame, you know, people who weren't even, and that might be a fault on my part, even when there are people in places of responsibility and power where they should know all of this. Because, of course, when it's abstract, you're pulled in 15 different directions because there are 15 different potential world-ending emergencies that experts are screaming at you about. So obviously, this one being the one that materialized, we should have been prepared. I guess next time we will be prepared for a pandemic. That's fairly certain. But I don't know. It's very interesting that you're saying the way you're looking at the West from Malaysia is like the way I was looking at the world of Contagion, the movie, having known what social distancing does. But I want to ask specifically about the U.S. as well. Obviously, we try to not be too over-emphatic on this show and to welcome all kinds of opinions and views respectfully. Still, there's no denying that the government in the U.S. is often, because of the person who leads it, fairly theatrical, let's put it like that. And so with that theatrical aspect in mind, are Malaysians or even English people, I suppose, how do they look at the US? We don't have a US person on the show today, but let's be proxies for them, or not proxies, but let's judge them because we don't have one to contradict us here. What do you think about the way it's been happening in the US? Hannah? Hello? Oh, well, the internet is being shifty again. I guess I'll ask the question to the unless Hannah is back. Are you back? She's not back. She's back, but she can't hear us. I'll ask...
Catching up there.
Yeah, I'll ask Paul then. What's your view / opinion on the way it's being handled in the U.S.?
As for me, it's probably right on par with most of the world. I think they're atrocious in that the way that their government has handled things. I mean, I get that they're a more regional country and their states have more power, and some of the states are a little bit better than others. But I mean, in general, like, you read the stories about how the states are having to, you know, fight with the federal government over getting supplies and how it's passing through private companies just to jack up the price and more profit for all those companies. And, you know, you see their protests for reopening stuff and whatnot. And I mean, don't get me wrong, we're having those lined up here in Alberta as well.
Really?
It's about two and a half, 3 weeks ago. Oh yeah, you guys had your yellow vest protesters in France for a while there. They sprung up here in Alberta and Canada in general for all the total opposite and wrong reasons for why you had yellow vest protesters in France.
Mm.
But we had a group of them about three weeks ago protesting in Calgary with big signs. The virus is a hoax. Our prime minister is, you know, caused this all, and he's lying to us. And
I mean, if the last few years have taught us something, it's that there are extremes that we will. I think psychologically, we're kind of structured to look at these and be scared because, you know, when there's a fire somewhere, then you need to start running. But they are as surprising as it is that they even exist, that, you know, people, some people refuse to vaccinate their kids. As surprising as that is, the fact is they exist. But they're also, I guess, for anti-vaxxers, it's a concerning number. But the people who go and demonstrate are a minority, right? The very right-wing people in the U.S., who go and demand reopening and say they want a haircut. There are a few dozen, a few hundred, maybe at most, in a state. And I'm being the devil's advocate here, but I think there should definitely be federal guidelines in the U.S., and the federal government should probably be directing things a little bit better. But at the same time, we just said, depending on the national, the geography of your local region, things are going to be very, very different. And as we know, the U.S. is very large, and different states have hugely different population density and situations and everything. So it might make sense to say, well, maybe not let every state fend for itself, but at least leave a lot of autonomy to the states in the way they're handling it. Have I convinced anyone of this? It seems all of these seem like reasonable arguments to me, even if, yes, there should be more guidance, I'm sure. But yeah, I don't know. I'll get back to Hannah. How do the Malaysians see the U.S.? Is it also seen as something of a spectacle, or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would say it probably doesn't dominate the headlines quite as much as over in Europe, I think. But, you know, especially in the way that they're handling COVID-19. But yeah, I mean, from what I've seen, people just, you know, Trump's comments about drinking disinfectant and everything else. I mean, that all gets plenty of coverage over here in Malaysia.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess it's the same everywhere, no matter where you're from. You know, I wonder if he, you know, another president was doing the exact same thing. Well, I mean, taking the exact same decisions from a federal standpoint, but wasn't a buffoon that was doing a spectacle on TV, I wonder if things wouldn't be considered less bad. Just because he is such a irresponsible in the way he communicates, I don't know. What I've started fantasizing about in recent weeks was, I would love to see a TV show where in an alternate reality, he would have lost the election, and how things would have been over the past 4 years with Hillary Clinton as the president. Just to imagine, and it would need to be a well-written show where it's not just, you know, she conquers the world and is triumphant, like she does everything well because obviously she's a Democrat, so everything goes perfectly. It would need to be a realistic take on, you know, the different, essentially, I guess, the West Wing, which is not super realistic.
Well,
but tries to...
actually, there
no?
was,
okay.
I don't know if you watch a show called The Good, whether you ever used to follow a show called The Good Wife, and then there's The Good Fight, which is like, it's kind of
yes.
follows lawyers in Chicago.
I love The Good Wife. I love The Good Fight. Don't spoil the last season. I'll watch it.
Okay, but... The latest season has come out, and the first episode is exactly that. It's what would have happened if Hillary had won. And it's very clever, very interesting.
Oh, my
actually.
God.
And it's not all roses.
Okay,
we
well
go.
Then, I mean, it is an extremely left-wing show, but it also has some times of reckoning and of... I think, yeah, I loved The Good Wife, and the spin-off, The Good Fight, is really good. I was surprised. So there you go, our recommendation for the day.
Yeah. Gotta go watch it quick.
And it's so great to have actors and actresses that aren't 20-somethings, which I'm not a 20-something anymore, but I don't know that that's the reason I like it. It's just, I don't know, it's refreshing. It's a great show.
Yeah, it's a smart show.
Yeah. All right. So I guess... is there anything else that either of you wants to add about how things have been going locally? Like things I might not really think about because I don't know your countries. So I just have, you know, my experiences as a frame of reference, or maybe even something that has nothing to do with the pandemic, potentially.
The only thing from Malaysia is that everybody now loves our health director general, or health DG, as they call him. Now, everybody's like, on social media, you just constantly see people heaping praise upon him. Little kids are writing him letters.
Really?
Framing the letters he writes back to them. There's like this hero cult forming around this guy, this civil servant.
Wait, what? How did that happen? I thought, like, because is it because the country did such a good job at containing it, or like because here, maybe it's because I have France as a frame of reference. Everyone is complaining about everything all the time, which again we have a lot of dead, so that makes sense. But it's because he did a good job.
I think it's just one because the government here is there's a lot going on politically anyway, and a lot of very negative perception against the government. And in fact, the current government, it's a bit complicated, but they kind of got in through a back door and were not the government that were voted in. So I think the virtue of this health director general is that he's a civil servant. So he's not a politician. And everything he says seems to make sense. And he's very... very sensible guy, and he's telling you the truth. And so I think everybody is just gravitating towards him, you know, kind of forgetting what the prime minister says. It's what does the health DG say? what should we do next? So maybe he'll be the next prime minister, who knows?
Well, that sounds incredibly refreshing.
yeah, nice.
I kind of want to live in Malaysia now.
Really?
Thank you very much. I don't know.
Food.
Yeah, it seems like everything's going pretty well.
So far.
Paul, what about Canada? Anything else you want to add before we close the show off?
Not much. We've been, like I said, we've done pretty well. I think our biggest thing was the federal government very quickly implemented a really good response benefit. Like the U.S. got their, you know, $1,200 check one time to help them out, whereas... they brought in what we call the Canadian Emergency Response Benefit, which is basically like an employment insurance. And even people who didn't normally qualify for that were able to apply for that and are getting $500 a week, tax free, basically, right now to help cover their expenses while they stay home and everything. And it's really sparked up a debate in the country about what we should be maybe paying everybody, and that, you know, if this is what the government considers the minimum amount of money you need to kind of survive, how do we justify companies that aren't paying that much when you work full time regularly? So that to me has been one of the bright spots, is that this kind of debate has come up. I know Spain has brought in something similar and working it as a universal basic income idea, which I think is an interesting thing to see how that'll happen. And that's kind of my thing with it, is to try to look at the bright sides, and that this is going to change how a lot of countries view what is required to survive, right? What people need to do to live, and that maybe we need to look at, you know, different ways of doing things. Do we need such dense cities nowadays when, you know, internet is becoming more readily available to work from home for everybody? And if we can cut back on all that, you know, cars on the road and stuff like that, we can, you know, make a bigger impact on things we didn't think we could before.
Yeah, it seems there's going to be changes everywhere. Certainly, I mean, one of the promises from the president when we get out of the crisis in France is a rethinking of the healthcare system. And we definitely have a better one than many other countries, but certainly it's underfunded as everywhere else in the world that do have good healthcare systems. There's things like autonomy on an EU level about many essential things, which is going to be thought of very, very seriously. But even smaller things, like in Finland, for example, when you're laid off, you get unemployment benefits, of course, for a couple of years. But if you get any income, or if you start a company, then you lose everything immediately. In France, for example, that's not the case. You can keep part of it, and it depends on the income you get, et cetera, et cetera. And so Finland is thinking, you know, these deeply ingrained philosophical choices almost that are being challenged a little bit, as you said, Paul, by the requirements of this situation. So there will definitely be things that, or it seems like there will be things that will be challenged and changed after this. Bill Gates wrote a really interesting article called, what's it called? The First Modern Pandemic, where he proposes calling it Pandemic One, as, you know, World War One and World War Two. Like, this is Pandemic One, and it's going to have a deep psychological impact on everyone who's lived through it and on the countries that have, well, the whole world. And I guess, you know, he's a smart dude. He knows what he's talking about. You wanted to add something, Hannah?
No, I mean, I think you're right. I think the only thing that we can try and do out of this, you know, like Paul said, is try and think of the positives of it, isn't it? If it's all for nothing and everybody just loses their jobs and everybody ends up in depression and gloom, then it's not, psychologically, that's not a very cheery thought either. So we've just got to hope that this all leads to something better, I imagine.
Well, let's do that, and let's try to look at the things that will be. We're still in the middle of it, but, and yes, there will be horrible things that will keep coming. But, you know, crises give us an opportunity to improve as well. So hopefully that will happen.
Yeah.
Thank you so much to both of you for being on the show. Before we leave, of course, I would like to ask both of you where we can find you on the internet, if you have a Twitter account that we can link to in the show notes, and your show, of course, Hannah. Where can people find more of what you do?
So you can find the show. It's the seasiatravelshow.com. So there's the podcast. And along there, you can find my contacts as well. Find me on LinkedIn, hannah.f.pearson. So I'll send them over to Patrick so you could have them in the show notes too.
Perfect. You don't have a Twitter account?
I do, but I don't really use it. It's Hannah F. Pearson as well.
Yeah, okay, no, well, I'll put your LinkedIn.
I'm not
your
active
LinkedIn.
Very much.
I'll put your LinkedIn. It's easier if that's what you use. Cool. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much for being on the show, Hannah. What about you, Paul? Do you have an active, fun, entertaining Twitter account? I'm putting a lot of pressure on you. To be clear, no one's Twitter account is actually fun. Everyone's Twitter account is depressing. So feel free to, you know, not be better than anyone else.
Well, I don't know if I'm depressing. I cut out a lot of that. I up until last week had deactivated Facebook for almost 3 months because I had been tired of the stuff on there. But I am on Twitter at Paul Jigger, spelled J-I-G-G-E-R, which was my abbreviated shortening of my French last name here in Canada. I mostly tweet about video games, beer and other stuff, but I have been getting into some political debates with people on there, and
that
I try
sounds
to keep
like
it
a,
pretty easy.
That sounds like a perfect idea. What, going into political debate in on Twitter. That sounds great.
Well, I keep my followers to the people I tend to agree with more. So I have gotten to the point where if you want to argue your insane, crazy, conspiratorial theory stuff without any evidence to back it up, I'm not going to follow and I'm not going to respond anymore. So I have started in this pandemic streaming on Twitch every now and then. So
cool.
I set up a channel on there under the name of Jaguar Farm Gaming. Named it after my grandpa's beekeeping farm that he ran when I was a child. So
very cool. All right. Well, the link to your Twitter account will be in the show notes. Thank you so much for being on the show. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I do Insta, as the youngins say. So go check out that if you're interested, if you're young like I am. And if you enjoy the show, again, patreon.com/thephidiousclub. You can support it there. And if you want to add something to the conversation, you can find the show notes and the show, the article with the comments at frenchspin.com. So that is where you can find all of that. Thank you so much for listening. And we will be back in a couple of weeks with another episode. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you then. Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.